Support for WAER Original Podcasts comes from California Closets of Syracuse, located in DeWitt. California Closets can help you get your entire home organized with custom-designed storage solutions for the home office, kitchen pantry, closets, and more. Online at californiaclosets.com.
Many of us grew up in an era where you watched professional sports and played video games. In fact, the only time I remember watching someone else play a video game was while waiting for my turn and secretly hoping the other person would lose so I could get back to playing sooner. But times have changed. Esports have become a major force in popular culture, with millions of viewers watching professionals and amateurs playing their favorite games through various streaming services like Twitch and YouTube. In fact, Rolling Stone magazine recently reported that esports revenue for 2021 would exceed $1 billion. I'm Kendall Phillips, and on this episode of Pop Life, we'll be examining the growth of esports and game live streaming. Here to help us understand the appeal of watching other people play video games and where this new cultural trend is heading is Dr. T.L. Taylor. Dr. Taylor is a professor of comparative media studies at MIT and author of several books, including the recent Watch Me Play, Twitch and the Rise of Game Live Streaming, and she is a member of Twitch's Safety Advisory Council. TL, welcome to Pop Life.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So as you heard, I'm an older gentleman, let's just say, and so I do have a little trouble wrapping my head around this idea of watching esports and competitive esports. So I'm wondering if you could say a word about where this came from and how it has so dramatically risen in popularity.
Yeah. Well, like you, I am also a little older. my first experiences with video games were in the arcades. But I think even the story you told at the outset, both of our experiences give us hints about the origins of esports, because people have always enjoyed competing, watching others and playing against each other, whether it was at the arcades or gathered around a home console, you know, handing off, taking turns, but also, you know, tallying up scores. And so in many ways, the moment we're in with esports right now, where it may look really glitzy, really hypey, its roots are in grassroots communities of just really passionate players who often loved a game title and loved the social and collective experience that came through competition. And in the same way, I often think, you know, it's really useful to sort of think about sports and esports and compare them. Really loved the challenge of trying to get better and better at their preferred game. So the roots are something I think probably both of us would recognize.
No, it's funny because I do remember, particularly at the arcade, the crowd of people around someone who was really good at, say, Donkey Kong or Pac-Man, and all of us watching in awe as the person was able to, you know, eat the dots and eat the ghosts, et cetera. But I'm wondering, are there particular, like, turning points where that grassroots community came to what you rightly characterized seems like a very glitzy, big money, exciting televised event? Now, what kind of led to those turning points to get to where we are?
Well, probably one of the most important ones was the growth of the internet. So, you know, people had long been competing, whether it was arcade tournaments. If anybody's seen, there's a fantastic documentary called King of Kong, which is about arcade competitions. People used to also, you know, send in videotapes of their high scores to a centralized place to compete. So when you get the internet, though, the ability to no longer just be the best player in your town or in your friendship network, that starts to expand. And so the internet is really one of the most powerful turning points for the growth of competition. And the book I wrote on esports really chronicles that early period. So, you know, competitive esports has been around for decades and decades. In my book on it, I chronicle the period from about 2003 to 2012. So this earlier period where the internet had come along, facilitating a lot more play, people were starting to think about, like, what does it look to try to scale this up? And the next big turning point, which is a part of the subject of my more recent book, is what happens when you suddenly get broadcasting readily available. So if the internet sort of extended the networks of play and competition, the ability to broadcast through live streaming platforms in a really robust way. That's the next big turning point. And of course, perhaps not surprisingly, that's when advertisers and, you know, other big money players start going like, oh, there are audiences. So we can sort of see these transition jumps in the history of esports.
Can you give us a sense of like the scale? Because again, as an outsider, I sort of start to see this talked about. There's esports now on our campus and clubs, et cetera, et cetera. But can you give us a sense of just how big esports are globally?
Yeah. So I would put it this way. I'm always a little bit cautious and wary of the economic numbers that get bandied about. So I'm not going to take that approach. I'm going to do something else, which is start with the fundamental thing that's happened to gaming in general, which is gaming has just become a mainstream leisure activity. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at the demographics of people who are playing, it's across the life cycle. Though there still remain important issues around gender and race and harassment, there's a tremendous number of women and girls playing as well now. So gaming has become mainstream, and competitive gaming is one slice of that larger change in gaming writ large. As you say, we're seeing now esports pop up on college campuses in much more formal ways. Again, esports has always been around. It's always been present. What's happened is things like live streaming have allowed this growth and amplification like never before. So we're seeing on college campuses, we're seeing it starting to be more formalized in high schools where there's high school leagues. And then of course there's the top tier, you know, professional stuff. So it's very widespread. I mean, you know, big tournaments will get, you know, hundreds of thousands of viewers. These are also esports competitions. The big ones are global media products. And I think that's something people don't often understand. You know, you may have a major, right before the pandemic, I was in China for a major esports event. And though the event was being carried out in China, that video feed, not dissimilar from the Olympics or even NBA basketball, which is huge in China, was getting piped out around the world. Localized, so you know, local translators, a whole schema of advertising and platforms that it was then on. So these are also global media products as well. So it's massive. It's massive.
Yeah, no, that gives a very good sense of the scope and scale. And so I'm wondering, and I know you write about this in some of your work, what's been the impact of the professionalization? Because I think about the movement from a group of teenagers standing in an arcade watching someone who's really good at Donkey Kong, or, you know, a group of friends playing competitively, up to tournaments. Now it's a global media product and there are professional esports athletes. How has professionalization impacted the culture of gaming and the practice?
Yeah, there's two threads I often think about with this. So the first is, I remember, and I recount this story in my esports book, I remember going to my first esports event. It was probably in 2003, and it was held at this little drafty warehouse in Denmark. It was actually a national finals for a big global tournament, but it was this, you know, rinky-dink, small, drafty. And I went there because I was interested in players. And as I was there over the course of a weekend, I noticed a guy in a suit. And I was like, what is this? What is this guy in the suit doing? It just made no sense. It was completely out of context. So of course, being the ethnographer that I am, I went up and talked to him. And it turned out he was a team owner. And he was there scouting talent and signing people to contracts. And at that moment, I realized, oh, when we're talking about the professionalization of esports, we're not just talking about players. We're talking about entire sets of institutions and organizations and emerging jobs that also have to build up around the scene to make it sustainable. So I think that's actually one really important thing for folks to understand. When we're thinking about professionalization in esports, we're not just talking about the players. We're talking about, to be honest now, media companies, sports teams, managers, coaches, the whole ensemble. In terms of the professionalization of players, you know, many of the core traits are still there. You know, you're talking about people who are very dedicated and very focused on improving their play, their skill. It very similar to athletes. I often think that one of the most defining things about professional players is their ability to try and fail and try and fail and, you know, go back and look at it and just the dedication and work. But I think one of the things that has happened that has tremendously changed the professional side of esports is with the growth of live streaming, more and more people have just become exposed to the fact that there are players who can make a living doing this. And that's an incredibly aspirational, you know, mode for a lot of folks. But again, not dissimilar from traditional athletics, you know, the number of people who actually meaningfully make a living and can attain that, it's nearly a lottery, right? It's a very, very hard path. The one other thing I'll say about the professionalization in our current moment versus some of the older ones, again, it's not dissimilar from what many folks experience are the ways social media now and the internet in general now shapes what it means to be a professional that has an online presence. But there's a fantastic scholar named Nancy Baim who's done really great work on musicians and the kind of engagements they have to have with their audiences and the pressures and the possibilities that come from social media. I think anybody working in the gaming space, the esports folks or the people who are live streaming, they often now have a whole audience of fans that have a little bit more continuous access to them. And that comes with some informal pressures. It can also come with some formal ones, you know, sponsorship deals, requirements to be present on streams, you know, endorsements. So again, not so dissimilar from traditional sports in many ways.
I'm wondering about the impact on like gamer culture. So again, I'm an outsider to this, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong. But my sense was always, at least in the early days, that gaming culture was kind of its own subculture and kind of guarded its boundaries. And it was designed to sort of be a little bit of an outsider. You loved gaming and you were into that. Now with sponsorship, now with money, now with professionalization, has that changed that aspect of gaming culture? Is it kind of more beholden to big money than it was maybe in the early days? Or maybe I've just romanticized the earlier days.
Yeah, well, this is a tricky question. So I guess I would want to answer it in two ways. One is I think you're right about the historical story gaming has told about itself of being kind of outsider. That said, I tend to argue gaming is always very much enmeshed and reflective and producing our broader cultural conversations. So it may want to hold itself outside, but it never is. It's always in the thick of our cultural moment. That said, the commercialization of game culture is certainly something that has been fraught. And I would say even within esports, the commercialization of esports is something that, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's as debated as much now as it used to be. I mean, that sort of early period I recount in my book, there were definitely people who were nervous about, you know, they wanted legitimacy, but were also nervous about what commercialization would also bring. And in fact, one of the kind of slices of competitive gaming that long held itself apart in some ways from the larger commercialization was the fighting game community, which really valued grassroots community-based engagement. But even, you know, that community has, you know, their major tournaments that have been bought out. Commercialization is infused even in that community now. It's a little bit become inescapable. And I think people have complicated feelings about that, but it's quite hard to escape. I mean, again, with something like live streaming, where you actually now have platforms where advertising is, you know, commercials are running amidst the game content, you know, there's no out there. It has become a platformatized and commercialized space.
And it's probably a little ironic to think about video gaming wanting to be outside money when you're playing a product that cost millions of dollars to develop, as opposed to, you know, say, soccer, where you just need a ball and a green. Yeah. I'm curious about this, and maybe this is not a good question, but has esports had an impact on traditional sports? I just think when I was young, again, you know, you sort of played video games, but then you would go out and play other things. And I'm wondering if particularly the professionalization, and as you say, this is now an aspirational direction. Someone can think, I can become a professional video game player. Is that impacting sort of other kinds of activities that young people, whether it's traditional sports or other kinds of activities?
Yeah, well, I mean, traditional sports organizations, a number of them, you know, one of the things they've been facing is seeing some declining viewership for certain sports and trying to figure out, you know, for them, the question of like, how do we make sure the young people are still watching? So a number of traditional sports organizations have bought esports teams, have started to think about what does it mean to spin up game competitions that can run off season. So European soccer teams are probably some of the most active in this space. So how do you kind of keep your traditional sporting audience engaged off season? How do you bring in new ones? So yeah, esports has had a profound impact. I think these are all still very experimental. I don't think anybody quite knows what to make of them. But yeah, they've absolutely become aware and attuned to what's happening in esports. The other thing I will just say too, though, is games writ large have had an interesting impact on sports. Yeah. One of the things I recount a story I read when I was doing my esports book, I read a piece which I'm going to forget the name of the footballer who made the move, but there was a football play that happened. And one of the sports reporters was like, that looked strange. And not only did it look strange, it looked like something I've seen in Madden, which is a popular football video game. And so we asked the player when he came off, what was that? That looked, and sure enough, it was because, as many athletes do, he'd been playing Madden. And the possibilities for play in that game spurred something outside of it. And I think that's also quite interesting. These moments where we move between digital play and offline play in really complex ways.
Yeah, I sometimes see, you know, NFL players talk about playing Madden, and it seems like we're through the looking glass at that point. Like the simulation is entirely imploded.
That's right.
But I'm wondering, you know, to some extent, again, sort of being the curmudgeon on the show here, I can understand watching really talented players play a game, whatever it might be, because of their skill. The same reason I watch European football or American baseball or something, just to see that skill. But as I look at something like Twitch, I see a lot of live streaming of games that are clearly not talented professionals. Some of them are not even that good, or a group of people playing who are not highly skilled professionals. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, what is the appeal for audiences to watch gaming among people who are not the super skilled e-athlete?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I think part of what I often try to help folks understand is there's a real heterogeneity on Twitch, both why people stream and why people watch. And you know, it's, as you say, it's really clear when it's a tournament, for example, or maybe you're watching an expert player practice. That's of course one of the most interesting differences perhaps from esports and traditional sports, is you could actually watch a player, a really top player, in their practice sessions. So that watching virtuoso play, I think most of us get. But, you know, people also watch because it can be, for example, that the streamer that they're watching is an amazing entertainer. I mean, it's almost the game itself is secondary, that they have, whether it's a comedic quality or an expressive quality. You know, good streamers are often, they're often very adept at like talking out loud about what they're doing and commentating on it at the same time. So you can be drawn to the personality of the streamer themselves. You can be drawn to the game. Maybe you're a fan of the game and there's something really powerful about seeing others play it. Or the other thing I think people often forget about Twitch is it's not just that you're watching a streamer. You're there with an audience and those people are chatting and you can see a whole community there. So depending on the stream, you may also be having a kind of social connection, whether that's direct chat or just that feeling of like, I am with others who love this thing I love. Maybe you want to learn something about the game. Maybe you want to preview the game before you buy it. Maybe perhaps most vexingly for the developers, watching it is enough. Like maybe you don't have the money. Maybe you don't have the time. So there's a multitude of reasons, and people watch different streams for different reasons at different times of day. One of my favorites is something I call in the book ambient sociality. Increasingly, I think people, they just have streams on in the background. I mean, I grew up in a house that always had the television on. So when yes. I saw that, I was like, yeah, that makes total sense to me. Like it's the TV on in the background. And I think this, again, sometimes I think the analogies, we can overdo the analogies or we can miss the specificities. But in this regard, I do think it's useful for people to think like, when we talk about why do we watch movies or why do we watch television, there's no singular answer usually, right? Like it's going to depend on the movie. It's going to depend on the show. It's going to depend the time of day, who we're with. There's all kinds of context and a range of reasons and taste. And streaming is actually similar.
Yeah, it makes a great deal of sense in terms of watching. And I do think, you know, one of the things you talk about in your book is that kind of affinity group, that kind of creation of community. And I'm wondering if that is a bigger part of, say, the Twitch platform, or at least a big part of the Twitch platform, is that it creates not just an avenue for watching, but kind of creating this community. So I'm assuming that people become kind of regular viewers, regular, you know, participants in these conversations, watching a particular Twitch streamer talking about the game, et cetera. Does it kind of create that communal atmosphere?
Yeah. I would say historically, especially the language of community has been a really important one on Twitch, especially in its early days when, you know, it was much smaller, you know, smaller streams, smaller streamers. People had it, the money hadn't quite flowed in the same way. So you didn't have quite as many big celebrities. So yeah, I think that community aspect, and in to my mind, the kind of the best streams, the positive ones that keep people coming back are ones that understand that. And it's not just that often those are channels in which the streamer and it's themselves is engaging with the community, but people who are watching are building communities with each other. And those communities may even have lives as well on a Discord server. So they, you know, they may have formed around a channel on Twitch, but maybe they're on Discord. Maybe they're playing games together. They may have other places that they're meeting up. But yeah, that community aspect is a really important one. And it's something that I think, you know, lots of people try to, there's been lots of attempts to build streaming platforms. And I do think Twitch keeps managing to have this interesting balance between it's not just about broadcasting. It is something else. It is this other layer of social interaction and engagement.
Yeah, because my sense is, you know, I think it seems like there have been efforts by sort of cable or network television to cash in on some of these things and maybe varying degrees of success. But it does seem like Twitch has that platform that allows you to not only watch and regularly tune in to see the live streaming, but create this kind of community relation through the interactivity of the platform.
Yeah, I always find it funny, you know, for a while, television was really big on saying like, we're going to do, you know, social TV and it's going to mean Twitter hashtags. And I was just like, boy, people need to be paying attention to Twitch, because if you want to see actual real-time engagement to the extent of even these strange experiments where the viewing audience is controlling the game that's being played on the screen, looking at live streaming has been to me a much more interesting place to see some of that develop.
It's almost like a different level of fandom in a way, the way you describe it. You know, that we could all be movie fans and get together and talk about movies, or create a platform where we can talk about movies. But now we're talking about movie as it's being made, and we're able to comment on it and you know, say that was a good choice or that was a really bad choice. So it's
it's funny, because it is true. One of the things I've actually always found really interesting about Twitch is how much it's not just been a place for games, but I've often thought of as a platform where process is on display. Because you can go and watch games on Twitch, but you can watch people like crafting jewelry or cosplay or cooking, doing things. And I think that's quite interesting, the pleasure of watching people do stuff or draw. Like you could go on Twitch now and watch people creating art. That the kind of pleasure of watching process unfold in sometimes very quiet, mundane ways. I mean, I have to admit, some of my favorite streams I've watched over the years have been people, you know, tinkering on a little piece of jewelry or trying to get their cosplay just right. And they just have a bunch of us sitting there watching them and they're kind of talking about it. But there's a lovely, sometimes quiet process side to what's happening on this these kinds of platforms as well.
No, it is something that we don't get to see as much. And so I guess there is that opening up a door to something that we don't get to see. We see the product, but we don't see the process. We don't see the building. We don't see the play. We maybe just see the final, or we don't see the practice, as you say.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm curious, you know, talking about Twitch, and I know you're not a spokesperson for Twitch, but I know you've been involved around Twitch for some time as a scholar and as an advocate and as an advisor. So one of the issues that often comes up is around this issue of safety. And you mentioned earlier the kind of increasing diversity and complexity of the gaming community. And of course, with that have been issues around border keeping and gatekeeping and some bad behavior. So I'm wondering, I guess part of what I'm wondering is, what is the responsibility of a company like Twitch or any other streaming platform to create or curate a kind of safe viewing communal environment?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important questions. So, and I really link it up to the larger questions, the larger things we're wrangling with in our culture about what does it mean to be able to participate on these platforms that are sites of culture? I mean, so for me, if I take the earlier point I made about the growth of gaming as just a mainstream leisure activity at this point, and for some, a mainstream professional identity or work activity, if I take that and I really start thinking about, well, what does it mean to be able to participate in sites of cultural production? Then for me, issues around inclusion, diversity, harassment, they pop to the fore because the stakes are quite high, I think. I think platforms have a lot of responsibility in this. Of course, I'm always heartened when communities are also doing the work to create positive spaces, and there's a lot of work they do, but I absolutely think platforms have to take these things seriously, and they have to provide not just tools for moderation, but I think they have to provide tools for communities to help to not just, you know, let me put it this way. One of the things we've spent most of the last few years focused on is what is often called the ban hammer model. It's about finding the bad actors and then, you know, you thunk them with the ban hammer, and maybe you deplatform them, right? And I think all of that is good and necessary, but I actually think we also need proactive models. We need models that are thinking about what are the tools to help communities amplify good work, build themselves, manage themselves in really healthy, productive ways. We cannot just spend all our energy thunking people. We actually have to build in systems that promote good communities. So it's a very delicate balancing act, but absolutely platforms have a huge responsibility in this space because it really matters. It's not, as I often say, games matter. They're not trivial, set off to the side. They are core sites of leisure and work and rest. They matter, and people should have full access to them.
And modeling of social behavior, social norms.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that games have rules and that they're meant to be fair, and all those sorts of things are things we wish our society would do, even if it doesn't always do that. So I'm wondering, I mean, the whole issue of the ban hammer and platforms and safety, of course, is beyond just game streaming. Certainly, you know, with the potential that Twitter is going to be bought by Elon Musk and a lot of conversation about, you know, Twitter banning people and those sorts of things. Do you have suggestions either for what platforms could do to promote these kinds of positive social behaviors, or also that what we can do as users, whether we're logging on to Twitch or Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, what we can do to promote a more pro-social, positive, safe environment?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a big question. I mean, so maybe I'll take a moment. I'm going to shout out. I co-founded an organization with Morgan Romine called anykey.org, which is focused on diversity and inclusion in gaming. And we have a bunch of white papers there. And, you know, we're trying to give, you know, both organizations and people tools and things they can do to try to intervene and make things a little bit better. The current director of research, Johanna Brewer, has an amazing inclusion 101 training up there. So this is to say, I think we have to tackle it at a range of levels. So this is everything from platforms, not only putting in reporting mechanisms, but that they are meaningful, they provide feedback, they let people know what's happened to their reports, right? So there's a whole layer of things there that platforms have tools in place to remove bad actors, that they have tools in place to give people the ability to manage smaller communities, all the way down to each of us as individuals figuring out what our strategies are for when we see things happen, when we're bystanders, how and when to intervene. I mean, it's a very complicated issue. I think there's a lot of good organizations out there now trying to provide tools to tackle this. So I think, you know, we need more conversations also, I would say, across communities, across platforms, across scholarly communities about best practices, what we're doing, what can work. Because I do think one of the things I really love about gaming is it's a space where a lot of interesting innovation happens. And innovation isn't always good. So sometimes it's really pernicious, toxic social innovation. But sometimes it's fantastic. And I would love to see folks who are concerned and thinking about social media and platform culture broadly be looking to what's happening in gaming. Because I will tell you, one of the things I'm most encouraged by, if you go on Twitch, there's so many often smaller communities that are working really hard to make it a good place for people. And it is work. It is definitely work. And I just hope we find ways to amplify and support that work even more.
Well, we definitely appreciate your work, and we'll certainly tweet out and put on our social media anykey.org where other folks can go. But in addition to learning about our expert guests' work, we also love to get into their pop culture loves. And so, TL, we usually begin this segment, as regular listeners will know, with a little game we call the Fast Five. So I'm going to ask you five questions. I'm going to give you an either-or answer. I'm going to ask you to follow your gut here and make some tough choices. So question number one, TL, if you were to take a ride around the Mario Kart track, who would you rather have driving, Princess Peach or Yoshi?
Yoshi.
I think it's
and I don't know why. I don't know why. It just seems more fun.
You got to follow your heart. The heart always knows. Question number two. If you had to compete in a high-stakes esports competition, would you rather be playing World of Warcraft or EverQuest?
Oh, no. That's not fair.
Pop life is a hard life, DL.
Oh. Well, World of Warcraft is a lot easier. And I say that having been an EverQuest player, so I'll say WoW.
Ah, good, because it is high stakes. So question number three for you. Which regular professional sports are you more likely to watch? Is it NFL football or MLB baseball?
Baseball, for sure. Baseball. I love going to a good baseball game.
Question number four for you. If you could only watch one game being played for the rest of your life, would it be Minecraft or Valorant?
Oh, I don't want either of those choices. Minecraft, probably.
Minecraft. All right.
Yeah, there's more possibilities. Because you could probably do Valorant in Minecraft.
I like your thinking. See, this is why she's at MIT. We understand. So finally, question number five for you, TL. If the digital world of video games just disappeared, which do you think would rise to prominence as the new popular game to watch? Would it be competitive Clue or high stakes Sorry?
Clue, for sure. I think there's a lot more interesting storytelling that might happen around Clue. Could be wrong. I'm going to say Clue.
I think the nuance, the sophisticated strategy would have millions and millions of watching. TL Taylor, you've been a great guest. What are you watching? What are you playing? What are you listening to these days?
Oh, shoot. I'm so bad at this kind of question. Okay, listening to, I like podcasts. So I've been, one of my favorite podcasts these days is called Maintenance Phase. I don't know if people know this one. Really interesting, really great, sophisticated methodology, but a lot of humor as well, around our culture's really screwed up relationship with food and weight. That's one of the things I'm listening to. What was the other one? What am I watching?
Just anything you're loving in pop culture. Any TV show you're loving, movies you've loved recently?
This is so hard. I've watched a few episodes and enjoyed it of Hugh Laurie did an Agatha Christie adaptation. I'm gonna forget the name. This is a terrible. I'm not good at this. I consume too much pop culture to be able to answer succinctly. Anyway, a little Agatha Christie thing. I'm a little bit in the mysteries and also true crime rabbit hole. So
this explains the clue answer earlier. T.L. Taylor is a professor at MIT and the author of several books, including Watch Me Play, Twitch, and the Rise of Game Live Streaming. She has been an amazing guest. We really appreciate you being here, T.L. And as a reminder to our listeners, whether your pop culture is streaming, screening, or spinning, odds are we'll be talking about it here on Pop Life. I will see you all next time.
Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. You can find archived episodes at waer.org, and don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen for automatic delivery of new episodes.